This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hi, you're listening to Queercast, Singapore's only LGBT podcast.
So very, very wet afternoon to everybody live from Hong Kong. As always, you're listening to Nick D. And today we have joining us on the show is Professor Ho Sik Yin. She's professor at the Department of Social Work and Administration at the University of Hong Kong. She's written extensively about gender and sexuality. Some of her past works include Pray the Gay Away, Identity Conflict Between Christianity and Sexuality in Hong Kong Sexual Minorities, Negotiable Intimacy, Expectations of Family, Relationship, and Filial Piety Among Only Child Parents, and Beyond Obedience and Virtue, Love, Sex, and Marriage in Hong Kong. All very, very interesting topics. Thank you for joining us on the show today. So let's start with sort of like a very broad question for those who are unfamiliar with Hong Kong. How are gay people sort of viewed in Hong Kong?
Ah, difficult question, because on the surface, looks like Hong Kong is quite a cosmopolitan city, and then you will always see the rainbow flag somewhere. And then on the surface, I think it doesn't look like this is a city full of gay bashing or anything like this. Mm-hmm. It's quite a peaceful, prosperous city. But then I, of course, I don't think that's the real picture of the situation of sexual minorities in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. I think we don't have anti-discrimination law on the ground of sexual orientation that tells you a lot about what's happening in Hong Kong. There is no law protecting sexual minorities' rights. And then also, not to say there isn't such a law. Even when the Equal Opportunities Commission wanted to launch a public consultation on this law, whether Hong Kong people want something like this, we were not allowed to do so. There was so much protest, so much Catholics, Christians protesting against launching this consultation. So there isn't, even if we want, we have, I myself also have conducted a report on gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender situation in Hong Kong, whether they have experience of being discriminated. And then Chinese U has also done a survey together with the EOC to look into the possibility of having such a law and whether the public accept this or not. So we have done many things throughout the years to show that actually there is a greater degree of acceptance on the part of Hong Kong people. But still, it's very difficult to just make it possible for this law to even have a ground to start off.
So why is that? Why is there then such a strong sort of religious lobby? You know, how did this come about?
It has always been like this in my past years of relating to this Christian groups, mainly Protestant Christian groups, who have always been very outspoken in back in early 90s when there was this anti-discrimination, decriminalization of homosexuality. Mm-hmm. When we first talk about the decriminalization of homosexuality in the context of the proposed Bill of Rights, mm-hmm. before England hand over Hong Kong
right.
to China. In that context, there was this proposed change just to decriminalize homosexuality, male homosexual conduct. When we say homosexuality, it actually means just right. anal sex.
Because lesbians are invisible.
Yeah, and also because that was the old Victorian law criminalizing people who practice anal sex, regardless of whether you are gay or whether mm-hmm. you are heterosexual. Even at that point, because my earlier work my thesis was on analyzing this type, the dynamics involved in the decriminalization of homosexuality in relation to the decolonization of Hong Kong. It has always been the Christian Protestant groups, not the Buddhist. The Catholics are slightly better. So it has always been this Protestant fundamentalist Christians who are very outspoken in saying, no, this is against nature, this is against Chinese cultural tradition, this is this will bring about social disorder. They have been using this argument for decades.
Right.
And now there is this new momentum, because homosexuality was decriminalized then, in 1991. Mm-hmm. And now there is an increased acceptance, I think, at the community level. And they notice it. And then they felt a bit threatened, I guess. So they have renewed their strength and organized themselves in the form of parents and school associations, parents and school alliance, and also the conservative pro-establishment political parties in Hong Kong, DAB.
I see.
They were allied together to fight against any introduction of law protecting sexual minorities.
So, I mean, you just picked up on one of the very common arguments that I used across Asia. I mean, even in Singapore, we still have the colonial law that we inherited from the British that still criminalizes homosexuality. And one of the arguments for the religious right over there is that it's against sort of Asian values. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we see that Taiwan, on the other hand, in 2 years' time, is about to pass same-sex marriage. Do you think that argument that it goes against Chinese culture still holds value?
Of course, I don't think Chinese culture is a valid argument. And of course, I don't think, in any case, Chinese culture is not a monolithic entity. And the modern Chinese culture has changed so much. And also in the Chinese tradition, we also have a history of dissidents making a voice heard. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Chinese culture is like this. But it has always been used. This argument has been used over and over again as just one defense against the battle for more equality.
Yeah, because I think that if the people that study Chinese culture, they would also understand that homosexuality has existed hundreds of years ago, even within the courts and in the dynasties, and all that is recorded, and it was part of Chinese culture. Mm-hmm. That argument, I think, has been hijacked by sort of the religious right to boost their side, basically. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned, you know, recently there has been some sort of momentum, and that is why, you know, the religious right feels threatened. Recently, there was a case of a Hong Kong gay civil servant who married his partner in New Zealand and then went to the courts to ask the court to grant his husband the same benefits as his heterosexual colleagues. The courts have ruled in favor of the gay couple, but the government is now appealing the decision. Do you think the courts will stand by its decision or overturn it?
It's very difficult to say. This morning, we just had a seminar to discuss about Hong Kong's future in 2047, after 50 years of this one country, two system thing, will still have this protection,
yes,
as provided by the basic law. There was so much argument about this rule of law and whether Hong Kong will be able to have social justice, will have this respect for rule of law. And it was there was a heated discussion about whether, of course, there is still this thing called one country, two system, and we see the erosion of this idea in every aspect, with the interpretation of the basic law. The central government can reinterpret the basic law time after time, and they are trying to institutionalize this power to reinterpret the basic law. They're trying to do something like this. That means everything that we feel are being given to us within the framework of the basic law is going to be eroded because they can reinterpret any clause in the basic law anytime they like. So in this sense, I don't know how strong our court, our judges are able to stand firm on the ground of social justice. I don't know. I still have a lot of faith in the Hong Kong court, in the judges. And I hope they will stand firm. They will be able to respect rule of law, the spirit of every law. They will be able to understand. It's not just about somebody infringe a specific law, either in the name of civil disobedience or other. It's not just about whether people have infringed the law. It's whether Hong Kong people is able to understand the spirit behind that particular law. It's also about whether Hong Kong people feel the law should be used to sort of constrain the power of those who have of the authority to oppress the majority.
Mm-hmm.
I think the spirit of the law is to constrain their power, not to make normal people's life difficult. So in the context of this change, of course, I really hope the law will be able to protect,
the civil servant.
We hope this, it will.
We'll hope that he will view in his favor. But you know, you mentioned the spirit of the law, and the spirit of the law is a rather abstract concept. So how can we then educate the wider public on sort of these nuances that are taking place in Hong Kong, which are very minute and they happen all over the place, but in the overall arching picture, you can see that there's a change developing. So how can we then educate the public about this change that is happening in Hong Kong?
We have to. We are now conducting this conversation at the University of Hong Kong. The universities in Hong Kong should play a very important role in making sure that we train up lawyers, we train up people who understand jurisprudence, who are not just standing on the side of the police and say whoever infringed on certain laws and rules and they should be put into prison. Not that kind of, you know, kindergarten mentality. We should actually educate our legal professionals. Many legal professionals have changed views, have become much, much more conservative, pro-establishment, and also Hong Kong people too have, you know, lately there was this case, this older woman, really old woman, 80-something, collecting this paper, cardboards, and then Filipino maid come over and say, I want to, and gave her $1, then she was criminalized, and she was sent to court, and because saying you are selling stuff on the street illegally because you don't have a hawker's license. Because of this $1 that has been given to this old 80-some-year-old woman for this. So we felt very disappointed that the law enforcement people and sometimes the general public and then the legal professionals, sometimes they would say, we are Hong Kong people, we respect rule of law, this is how we do things. If you violate the law, you'll be punished and you will be sent to court, you'll be in prison. It's very, very disheartening, it's very, very disappointing to know Hong Kong people, and including some professionals, would go that far. And of course the police, and also people, the government people who have issued this note to her and say that now you have infringed on this hawkers license stuff. And I think this is happening everywhere. This is happening. That was just the most recent incident. There's so many incidents. For example, this Occupy Central trio, and also these protesters during the Umbrella Movement, they're now facing subversion.
Subversion of justice.
Yeah, and then they are treated like they're traitors. They're traitors of the state, the traitors of the Communist Party, they're traitors of Hong Kong government. And I think this is, we have to educate people. The universities has a very important role to play. And also, we have to have seminars, we have to train up civil society, we have to strengthen civil society, improve the quality of our education. It's not just that type of moral education, not particular type of national education. We should be able to encourage citizens to question, to discuss, to understand the cultural issues in the implementation of law, to understand basic law, to understand other legal systems, to understand what is happening to Hong Kong. And I think that is very important. Otherwise, it's not just LGBTQs. They mm-hmm. would never have the protection that they so needed. But also, Hong Kong will also be descending to hell.
I mean, you're absolutely right saying that, you know, the struggles are all interconnected. You know, the community cannot just rely on itself. It has to look on the broader civil society. And if civil society strengthens and is strong, then the minority rights also will become strong and strengthened. Now, you know, the 20th anniversary of the Hong Kong handover is coming up, you know, and, you know, like you mentioned, you know, people are afraid of Beijing's growing influence. And in response, there has been a movement in Hong Kong, like you say, Occupy and the Umbrella Movement, to try to call for Hong Kong's independence. But personally, you know, you...
This episode of QueerCast was possible thanks to the support of our community collaborator, Uga Chaga. Uga Chaga is a non-profit counseling and personal development organization for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and questioning individuals. They do incredible work for the community, and you can help them continue their good work by donating. Visit www.ugachaga.com. And we want to say thank you to you, our listeners. If you want to stay updated on new episodes or have an early sneak peek of future guests, follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Links to all our social media handles and our partners can be found in the description. Thanks, and we love you.
I hope that Hong Kong will be a more democratic place. Before the colonial rule, before the British left Hong Kong, I have always felt that the government is on my side and I'm on the same side of the government, because they are, at that point at least, even though it's the colonial government, it has always respect our freedom of speech, and then they are also trying to give us a little bit more democracy towards the end of the rule. So I felt I don't have to do much. I didn't need to be so angry because I was on the right side, and most people on the right side. It was only just some more really, really very conservative pro-Beijing people who are sort of our opponents. But after the handover, things have changed so much. With the new government, slowly and steadily, you see the change. You see how the new boss, the Beijing government, is not like our ex-boss, the colonial government, in the way they look at freedom, they look at rule of law. So at that point, I already felt I could not leave my responsibility to my friends in the Democratic Party or to the Democrats. I felt a bit more that I needed to do more. So we were on the street. We protested every year. We protested July 1st, especially after 2003. We protested. We have done more as a Hong Kong citizen to take note of the democracy movement in Hong Kong. But then after the Umbrella Movement, I couldn't help involving myself, because I have witnessed this police violence. I have witnessed how there is this very unequal relationship between the government, especially the Beijing government, the central government, and Hong Kong people, and how Hong Kong people's voice were being ignored, were being our quest for freedom has been suppressed. So I saw it more clearly, and I have witnessed this more clearly, and so I felt my responsibility to say more, to be more outspoken. But at the same time, I have noticed, because there are a lot of people like me who have previously been rather, you know, passive, and now they have a stronger feeling about social movement. And I think this has threatened the government, threatened the central government, and also there is this tightening up of control of civil society. And so I felt, on the whole, I think I felt more pessimistic than ever about Hong Kong's future. Of course, that has been there. But then I don't have a choice. It's not whether I have decided to be optimistic or pessimistic. If I'm not leaving, if I'm not going away, if I want to treat this place as my city, as my home, I have no choice but to be more vigilant of all these things that have make the erosion of freedom more serious. I have no choice but to be a part of the civil society to protest against all these infringement of rights. And also because of my research interest, so I've always been on the side of this sexual minorities. Mm. So I just feel all these things have made it difficult for me not to be a part of a social movement for democracy and for, of course, LGBTQ rights. But then I wouldn't say I first and foremost is LGBTQ rights, not because it is not important, but because I don't feel that it's the priority of the government. It's not the priority of Hong Kong people. Hong Kong people don't care too much about sexual minorities' rights anyway.
Mm.
So I feel that maybe our effort should be devoted to fight for democracy of Hong Kong, to really hope that we will one day be able to have genuine universal suffrage, that everyone will be able to cast one vote, to select our chief executive, and have the right to be nominated and have the right to nominate any citizen to stand for election.
So, but, you know, having said that, it seems that right now the direction of the conversation is that it's being polarized, whereby there is one faction that is strongly opposed to Beijing's influence, and on the other hand, there is a faction that wants Beijing to have control over Hong Kong, right? So this, in that sense, if the conversation continues to move apart, then it doesn't become productive. So then how can we move back to the center? How can we then engage and have conversation, you know, with the other side?
There are many arguments. Some said, for example, the pro-establishment people, like Zhang Yuxing, ex-DAB chairman and also the chair of the Legislative Council for many years. So he's just one example. So people like him, he's considered to be more enlightened among the pro-establishment people. There are those who are very barbaric pro-establishment people. But even on the enlightened faction of the pro-establishment people, they would say we should have conversation. We should have the capacity to accommodate differences, and we should talk, we should negotiate. That's one way of putting it. Of course, theoretically, that's possible. But the point is, it's not up to we Hong Kong people to decide whether such negotiation will take place. Who wants to listen to you in the first place? So it's not up to us, of course. But if you ask us, those who are on the social movement people, if there is a negotiation, would you be willing to come forward? Would you be willing to sit around that table? I would say it's very difficult, because in this sort of negotiation, it's not really negotiation. It's never equal. And also, there are so many things happening around us. For example, many people got prosecuted, many movement activists will be in jail maybe for many years. I mean, many of these things are happening, and then you cannot just ignore all these things that have happened to your friends, your comrades, to Hong Kong people, to Chinese people, to all the human rights lawyer, to activists all over China. You cannot ignore all these background and who's right or wrong kind of judgment to come to this table as if we are just going out for a casual dinner with some acquaintance. You cannot treat it like this. So, of course, theoretically, negotiation is important. But negotiation on this very, very unequal ground, and I would never want to participate in a part of this negotiation. And I don't want the Democrats to, you know, ignore all these things, the actual happenings, actual experience we have, the experience of the dissidents, experience of Hong Kong people, experience of mainlanders who have been under very strong authoritarian, if I wouldn't say dictatorial rule.
Wow.
So I wouldn't be able to ignore all these things to come to a negotiation table. And also, nobody would be naive enough to think that something like this will ever happen, because they wouldn't want to listen.
Wow.
So I think the only way out is for, I think there is still some hope, not in the sense we'll be able to change China, we'll be able to bring about true revolution, not like this, but I still feel there is a hope that we will be able to keep this voice, keep this, to make this voice heard by the Beijing government, by the international arena, by people all over the world. We still want to go to this Victoria Park to protest June 4th every year, 1st of July. I always wanted to go to lit my candle because I want that picture. Mm. I want people to see. I want people all over the world to see Hong Kong people. This is what Hong Kong people are experiencing. And they are still holding up that candlelight, that's very frail candlelight. I want the world to see. And I want the world to know this is not the problem of Hong Kong people.
Mm.
In every city, there are Chinese under surveillance. There are Chinese who are so scared about Communist Party. Every city is about the problem of Chinese people all over the world. It's about every city who wants to trade with China.
Yes.
Who want to benefit from Chinese prosperity, who want the Chinese market. They will be treated like us.
Yeah.
So Hong Kong problem, it's not Hong Kong problem. It's the world's problem. If you want China to take the lead, to be, you know, creating all these alternative facts like Trump, if you want the world to be like this, our future is your future. You will be like us very soon. So I just feel I want to be able to say why Hong Kong is important. I don't want to see anyone, LGBTQ people, being marginalized. I don't want to see Hong Kong people marginalized. I want the world to see how LGBTQ people are being treated here, how Hong Kong people are treated under Chinese regime is the future for everyone.
Wow. So, I mean, thank you so much for sharing your insights. And I really admire your energy and your spirit. And we will definitely be, you know, keeping a close watch on things and how they develop, because, as you said, they will have an impact on the rest of the world. So once again, you've been listening to Nick D, and I'm here with Professor Ho. And we will hopefully talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
This episode of Queercast was possible thanks to the support of Joy 94.9 in Melbourne, Australia's only LGBTI radio station who hosts our podcast. Keep queer voices on air and on podcast by becoming a member today at joy.org.au. We also have to thank our community collaborator, Uga Chaga, a non-profit counselling and personal development organisation for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender and questioning individuals. They do incredible work for the community, and you can help them continue their good work by donating. Visit www.ugachaga.com. Lastly, we want to say thank you to you, our listeners. And if you want to stay updated on new episodes or have an early sneak peek for future guests, follow us on Facebook or Instagram. Links to all our social media handles and our partners can be found in the description. Thanks, and we love you.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.